On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
Welcome to Easter Sunday on the Bookshelf on WTBF. Our very special guest today is Dr. Sandra Glahn, who is the editor of an amazing new book called Vindicating the Vixens, Revisiting Vilified, Sexualized, and Marginalized Women of the Bible. It's from Kregel Academic, which is a division of Kregel Publications. We're tying this into Easter because the women we're going to discuss today come from the genealogy of Jesus found in the first chapter of Mark in the New Testament of the Bible. These women, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, and the Virgin Mary, are the first chapters in this amazing volume. So, Sandra, we'd like to welcome you back to On the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Sandra, by the way, is professor in Media Arts and Worship at Dallas Theological Seminary, where she teaches courses on the arts, gender, and human sexuality, holds a Master of Theology from Dallas Theological Seminary, and a PhD in the Humanities Aesthetic Studies from the University of Texas at Dallas, and is the author or co-author of more than 20 books, including 10 Bible studies in the Coffee Cup Bible Study series, and both fiction and nonfiction relating to bioethics, sexuality, and reproductive technologies. So, let's talk about these women. I've heard them described as the scandalous women of Jesus' genealogy.
Isn't that unfortunate?
yes, it really is. I've always thought of them as the Gentile women that were grafted into the Jewish tree.
I think that's how you're supposed to see them. I think better yet, probably how the original audience would have received them.
Yeah.
There are plenty of scandalous people, men and women, in Jesus' genealogy.
Oh, yeah.
But what tends to happen is we say the women are scandalous and then the men are just men. And we think that the reason the five women are in the genealogies and the rest are men, there are exceptions to be there. It's unusual for a woman to be in the genealogies in the ancient Near East, but again, we focus in on thinking there's something scandalous about them, something sexually immoral about them, rather than re-looking at their stories and seeing these were incredible Gentile women of faith that were grafted in.
You have put together an impressive set of people who are the authors of the essays in the book Vindicating the Vixens. How did you get together with them? Were these people that you knew from classes that you taught?
They weren't even all from DTS. So I used to be the magazine editor for Dallas Seminary and for about almost 20 years. And so that gave me access to some of our really good writers.
Right.
And I also just sort of paid attention through the years to who was actually doing a lot of research on Tamar, who was doing research on the woman at the well. And I just sort of kept a list. This has been a dream project for me for about 10 years, and I didn't want it to be a book for women about women. I wanted it to be men and women re-looking at some women in the Bible who we've neglected or we've missed the point of their stories and consequently made some major mistakes in our understanding of the bigger picture. So it was just a combination, really, of knowing who some of the good writers were, so hopefully they'd write good chapters, but also knowing that they were experts in these areas. So we got an Arab scholar looking at Hagar. We have an Australian scholar walking through how do you interpret the Bible before we even begin. We have a woman in Edinburgh who's a scholar there. So it's sort of all over the world, black, white, you know, surnames like Zasueta. So that it's different sorts of eyes looking at the text, in addition to, you know, I'm white middle class and have men on the project who are white middle class men. We just wanted everybody, as many people as possible at the table.
One thing that's consistent is the scholarship is solid all the way through the book. And that's one of the many things that I liked so much about the book. I also like the fact that we're talking about really doing is dispelling a lot of the incorrect interpretations and the myths and the misunderstandings
Correct.
About these women that have been, at some point over the last 2,000 years, merged into our stylistic understanding of the Bible. And in many cases, they're given a really completely unfair sort of coloration as to what were their motives and what was their
right.
what was their moral character.
Right, and even their age. If we look at a Mary Magdalene who, you know, in Mel Gibson's work and in a lot of Titian, you know, she's a reformed, you know, lady of the night. Or then you have Jesus Christ Superstar where she's like Jesus' girlfriend. You know, she's a wife of Jesus and Dan Brown. So it's sort of two extremes. She's either his wife, but it's always a romantic interest in some way. Mary Magdalene, if she's a wealthy woman of her own means, it, you know, coming from the town of Magdala on the Sea of Galilee, she's probably an older woman who has inherited and didn't have any brothers. So that it's, you know, it's unusual for a woman to be independently wealthy at this point. But Luke records that she's one of the women who are traveling with Jesus and supporting him out of her means, which means she's not 22 years old.
Right. Yeah, she wouldn't have any way to make any money if she was 22 years old.
Exactly.
And, there was another author, and I talked to her when her book came out about 10 years or so ago, and she addressed Mary of Magdala, and she, one of the things that she pointed out in the book, which your scholar here also authenticates, is women who are crazy are not sexy. And if they're inhabited by demons, they're crazy.
And if you just do a word study, so the Bible says that Mary Magdalene had 7 demons cast out of her by Jesus. That's really all we know about her background. But if you do just a word study on demons, you don't ever see sexual connotations. That doesn't mean there can't be any. It just, that should not be the first thing that we think of. It should be more like suicide, darkness, cutting, you know, really, really those sorts of troubles rather than promiscuity.
Right. Of all the demoniacs in the Bible that are men that Jesus exorcises, none of them are sexually promiscuous.
Exactly.
They're running around frothing at the mouth, ripping their clothes, screaming at people.
Living in cemeteries. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I do want to talk about the Old Testament, the genealogy women, too. A Tamar, who is really given a hard time because of what she has to do to survive, and your author, Carolyn Curtis James, does a marvelous job in explaining why later on in that little sequence does Judah proclaim that she is more righteous than he is. And if that's the case, then why in the world do we look down our noses at her?
Right. So you have this story, and typically when we learn our outlines of Genesis, we go Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. But we should be saying Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Judah, because Joseph, you know, saving his family from famine is part of the bigger story, which is the preservation of the family of the line of Messiah and the miracles that God is pulling off to make that happen. And so you have this son of Jacob, one of the 12, who sold his brother Joseph off to slavery, and he's really, Judah is an utter reprobate. And so he's shown as, this, first of all, a wicked brother. And then he has these 3 sons, and he goes and finds a wife for them from the Canaanites, which is bad news for somebody of Semitic descent. Like, that's not what you're supposed to be doing if you're a son of Abraham. And so the first one is married to her, and it says in the text that God killed him because he was so wicked. And so the second brother takes her, and God kills him because he's so wicked. And so Judah promises the third son, because there's this law called leveret, or the law of the brother-in-law, which is designed to keep a woman from starving to death. If your husband dies and he doesn't have an heir, a woman can't just go put on her heels and go find a job. She is dependent in a patriarchal culture on a man to eat. And so Judah says, go back to your own father, you know, to eat there until my youngest son is old enough to marry you off to. And time goes by, and she realizes he's not going to marry me to him. And not only does that mean she's going to be hungry in her old age, but it also probably, Judah knew the promises that had been given to him that he's the messianic line. Mm-hmm. And he's just not interested in carrying it on. So Tamar is. Tamar is wanting to give these wicked men a legacy. And so the text says, is careful to point out that Judah is widowed, which in the ancient Near East means he's also eligible to fulfill that responsibility of carrying on the line. And so she disguises herself and is sure enough that he's a reprobate, but he's going to take the bait, and disguises herself as a lady of the night, and he does. And she takes his ID card with him, basically.
Yeah.
And so when it turns out that she's pregnant, he calls for her to be burned to death. He wants an honor killing. And she pulls out the ID. And what an utter hypocrite, right?
Yeah.
Hello. But it is at that point where he said, and then some texts translate that, you are more righteous than I, which suggests he thinks he's righteous. But, you know, Carolyn James makes a good case in the chapter in this book. Translate it, you're the righteous one, not I. And the very next time we see Judah, something dramatic has happened to him. He's offering his own life in exchange for that of Benjamin, the brother of the one he stole up the river, basically. Something, I mean, he has gone from being only caring about his own self to willing to exchange his life for that of probably a favorite brother.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not his favorite, but his father's favorite.
Right.
And, you know, something dramatic has happened in his life, but because we so often think that the Tamar story is a weird little narrative in Genesis, we even skip it all together to get back to the Joseph story, and we don't even see the character arc that's happened in Judah. That's one of the women in Jesus' genealogy.
Yeah.
And in the book of Ruth, when it says that, you know, Ruth finally has a baby, the people in the town are saying, may you be like, you know, the line of Tamar provided, basically.
Yeah.
This is not what families do when they want to sweep something under the rug and they're embarrassed by somebody or ashamed. They don't pull them out in the family blessing and put them in the genealogy. So we need to reclaim Tamar for valuing something that the insiders didn't value. She's the outsider in every way, and yet she values what is valuable to God.
I'm also was glad to see Rahab, such an interesting person. I've read the chapter in here that is by Eva Bleeker.
Yeah.
Talks about Rahab and why Rahab gets a bad rap.
So, you know, her reputation before she comes on the scene is that she's, you know, a professional sex worker. But she has this incredible, another huge character arc. Here is this woman. What is Jericho? It's the first city in Canaanite territory that God wants, you know, to be claimed in the conquest. She's all the things that you don't want. Like, she is a powerless woman. She's in the worst occupation. She's a Canaanite in a doomed city. And you send in the spies who have had every access to the miracles of God. They've just come out of this incredible military victory over these two kings that most of us have never heard of, but they're very essential. Like, if you see them in Israel's history recounted, they show up. But Sihon, you know, these two big kings, God basically just kind of wipes out their legacies with no effort whatsoever. And it's terrified everybody in Jericho. And so when these spies come, it's interesting that the text never says a word about, you know, you had one job. And they managed to just get themselves caught. Meanwhile, Rahab, the least likely person in the world, is saying, Yahweh, your Elohim. You know, she's using three different names of their God and knows about the Dead Sea, which happened 40 years earlier, and the more recent victories. And like, it's like the four spiritual laws. She's prayed the prayer. She's, you know, she's in. And that is remarkable when you think about how little light she had to go on. And again, we remember her for what she used to do instead of her incredible faith. She's remembered in Scripture in the faith chapter of Hebrews as a woman of faith. She's held up elsewhere in the New Testament as a great example of someone who exercised faith. But faith is not the first thing that we think of when we think of Rahab.
Yeah, and that really is unfair. Yeah. Talking, in case you're just joining us on this Easter morning, to Dr. Sandra Glahn, who is the general editor and contributor to Vindicating the Vixens, Revisiting Sexualized, Vilified, and Marginalized Women of the Bible. It's from Craigle Academic, which is a division of Craigle Publications. If you'd like to get in touch with Sandra, you can also check her website, www.aspire2, that's two like the letter two, .com. That's her also her Facebook page. You can tweet her at Sandra Glahn, SANDRAGLAHN. It's amazing to me that Ruth gets a bad rep at all. I think it's because of the instructions that her eager mother-in-law gives her. And they do sound a little fishy. But on the other hand, once again, we're looking at something that happened 3,000 years ago. And a different culture and a different way of men and women relating to one another than we do now. If a woman was to do now what Ruth did, then that'd be pretty scandalous behavior. But it wouldn't have been 3,000 years ago.
No, she's putting Boaz in a situation where he does not have to be shamed. Like, he can save face. He can make a decision about what he wants to do with absolutely no social pressure. And there's really no time in her life that she can just walk up to Boaz and have this conversation.
Right.
She's going to have to approach. The only way she can approach him privately is under the dark of night. So here you have, again, here's somebody from Moab, which is, you know, known for sacrificing their children to their idols. You know, she has an older mother-in-law who's widowed. She's very concerned that this means this woman's going to starve. she insists, I'm going with you back home. When her own husband dies and the father-in-law dies and the brother-in-law dies, she's not going to desert Naomi. She's saying, where you go, I'll go. You lodge, I'll lodge. Your God is my God. Your people, my people. And the next scene, we pretty much see her out threshing wheat, hustling to make enough money to feed this hungry mother-in-law. And ultimately, you know, it's suggested by Naomi, the mother-in-law, that you could propose to Boaz. He's a good guy. He's wealthy, and he would take care of us. But the thing is, I come with the deal. He's going to inherit a mother-in-law. And so let's not publicly shame him if he says no, because he's really not the first in line to do this. It's not his responsibility. And he says to Ruth, you know, there is one who's closer. Let me check it out. And that one who's closer doesn't. And so Boaz is saying to her, man, you know, you are an incredible woman. I've heard of you, of the kindness that you're showing to Naomi. And this second kindness of you proposing to me is not that she's being kind to him so much as like she could marry a younger man. But she's basically saying, but my mother-in-law will eat. My mother-in-law will be cared for if I am in the house of Boaz. So both Boaz and Ruth get high props for going way beyond the letter of the law, the spirit of the law. That scene in the threshing floor is considered shady, yeah.
They're both such righteous people that when we remember the character that they exhibit throughout the entire book, that should give us a clue as to what's going on
exactly.
on the floor of the threshing chamber, too.
Yeah, right.
They're surrounded by other people.
And this is the mother-in-law's suggestion.
Yeah.
Not like her fun girlfriend saying, hey, go, you know, go proposition Boaz.
Yeah.
This is the mother-in-law saying, "Here, you know, here's what you need to do." Not that a mother-in-law would never do something scandalous. But again, as you say, when you look at all the other character descriptions of these people, you're like, it's just not sensible to think that there's this one crazy little incident in the middle where they lose all sanity.
Yes, all sense of propriety and go. Speaking of which, that kind of leads us directly into Bathsheba. I'll be honest with you that my thinking about Bathsheba's role in this sordid situation with King David has been affected by a woman in the church that I pastor who has been maintaining, for as long as I've known her, that Bathsheba was essentially a victim of sexual harassment and that it was not a consensual relationship because he was the king. And women don't usually get the option of saying no to the king, even if they wanted to.
Especially if he's your husband's boss, especially if he sends soldiers, plural, to get you. And not only that, she probably didn't know why they were coming to fetch her.
Yeah.
If her husband is at war and the king sends for her, wouldn't you think, like, your husband is dead?
Yeah.
This is probably, you know, like people knocking on, you know, two soldiers knocking on your door and you know the news is bad.
Sure, especially because he was one of David's original mighty men. This is not just a random guy. He's been with David for 20 years.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. That's right. So there's nothing at all in the text that puts any responsibility on Bathsheba. So the point of our book is not to vindicate every bad woman in the Bible. For example, Potiphar's wife, she deserves what she gets, right?
Yeah.
She is seducing. It's not that we're saying women don't do that. We're saying you have taken women who weren't doing that, folks, and you're misinterpreting it. And the problem with that is pretty much all the good women in the Bible we've just thrown under a bus, and we have very few role models. And we also miss what's going on in the text. So with Bathsheba's story, the point is not to warn men that women are dangerous. We're supposed to be reading that story through the point of view of David.
Yeah.
And here is this guy who is this little, helpless, nobody shepherd that God pulled off the backside of the wilderness and raised him up to be this incredibly mighty king. What is he doing?
Yeah.
He is abusing power. And especially since, you know, the Bill Clinton incident and the Harvey Weinstein, like we know now more and more about power.
Yeah.
And how even if something appears consensual, you have to factor in that power, if it's a physician with a patient, if it's with a pastor with a parishioner, there's a different kind of power differential that makes the person with more social power especially accountable for using that power to protect the people who have less power. And that's exactly what's happening with Bathsheba here, the wife of a soldier. Again, she, you know, Uriah the Hittite. You know, they're probably not, you know, they're probably Gentiles, right? And again, you're seeing this pattern of the people that should have been the least likely people to be righteous and these foils of the people who should have gotten it who aren't. And I think often this pattern is to show God is listening to anyone.
But that's really part of the narrative of the story of Hagar, that God is listening to her.
That's his name,
That's the integral to the entire story of Hagar, that Abraham sends her out in the wilderness because his first wife says, I just don't want her around anymore. Get rid of her and her rotten little kid. And Abraham says, what am I going to do? He doesn't seem to have, even though he is a righteous guy, doesn't seem to be all that assertive about things, except on the mountain with Isaac. But every other time that he gets tested, he does stupid stuff.
I mean, let it be an encouragement to us all, right? The
faith chapter
could just as easily be, in many cases, most cases, the foul-up chapter. But unfortunately, we've taken these stories and assumed that is the point of them being in the genealogy. And I think we've missed the boat. It's true, absolutely, that God is constantly using, you know, people that are frail, you know, all of us. But their point in these stories, that's really not what we're supposed to be seeing. We're supposed to be seeing faith, supposed to be seeing response to very little light and responsibility for those of us who have all kinds of access to the truth and miss it. When we can't go without talking about the Virgin Mary, right?
Right.
Well, we think, well, Mary, there's no scandal with Mary, except there is. You know, we tend to think, well, everybody knew that, you know, Mary probably was pregnant out of wedlock, but, you know, she's a virgin. But probably that's actually not what most people thought about. It was early enough that Joseph wanted to put her away quietly because the whole world didn't know. And Protestants have a tendency to ignore Mary because we've come out, you know, the Protestant church came out of the Catholic church. And so, you know, it's sort of an overreaction to what some wrongly say is Mary worship in the older Christian traditions. And so we go the other extreme and just don't even look at her at all, even though she's the fourth most mentioned person in the New Testament.
Right. She's an important member of the entourage of Jesus. Not only is she the mother of Jesus.
Yes.
Of the incarnate Son of God, but she's involved, and she's there through all the good and through the very worst.
Yeah, who's the primary witness of the birth narrative, Mary? Who's the primary witness of the death narrative, Mary? Who's a primary witness of the resurrection, you know, Mary, the ascension, Mary? Like, you know, the core doctrines of the Christian faith depend on the witness of Mary. And so we have tended to focus in on, but she thinks her son's crazy at one point, so, you know, we're just going to write off everything else she did right. And we need to reclaim Mary as somebody totally worth following. There is no precedent in history for a virgin birth, and she's saying, okay, you know, if you say so. Meanwhile, there's totally precedent for a baby born to an old couple, but, you know, Zechariah's like, I'm just not sure I can believe.
Right.
And again, the point is not to throw men under the bus. In fact, in our book, we exonerate a couple men, Boaz being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But we just need to more accurately handle these people, how the text handles them.
Do we want to talk about, there certainly are other women we could talk about that we could rehabilitate, or rehabilitate their reputation anyway. That's for sure. But the point that Sandra is making, again, is that these are people who, all of the folks that contributed to this book are people that believe the Bible to be true but want to interpret it faithfully and
correct.
To do it correctly. And that means you have to read the whole thing, and you have to also know something about the background and the culture and all of those things. We can't read, far too many people do it. Read the Bible as though it was written a week and a half ago. And that's not fair to the people in the Bible.
Right. And we miss really important stuff like God's heart for the outsider.
Yeah.
And God's ear to those who are powerless. And God's concern that those of us who have access to Scripture are not the abusers. I mean, there are just so many things we miss.
Look at time and time again, Jesus talks about how much God loves the poor.
Yeah.
And yet nobody wants to be the poor. But if you meet somebody who is economically disadvantaged, I have met people around the world, had the great privilege of going on musical mission trips around the world. And I can tell you, where the poorest people are, church is the strongest there because they don't have 401ks to fall back on.
Yeah. Well, and they're certainly not on their iPhones all day. You know, swiping better things to do. I think, you know, one more woman that really brings up, I think, is a poor woman, is the woman in John chapter 4, the woman at the well, or the Samaritan woman.
Yes.
Because this is probably a woman where when Jesus says, go call your husband, she said, I don't have a husband. He says, that's true. You know, the one you had five and the one you have now isn't your own. And we read that to serial monogamous, can't keep a husband because she's immoral, and now she's living with some guy, because those are all how Westerners would understand a woman who'd had five marriages and is, you know, now isn't her own. But if we take what we know about the Eastern narrative, which is women couldn't just walk into a court of law and testify on their own, they had to have convinced a man to go with them and sort of speak on their behalf. And if we also know that the number one cause of death at this time for men is war, and we know that the average woman has to have five children just to keep zero population growth, then maybe we should think this is, again, not a 21-year-old woman. This is a woman who has lost husbands repeatedly. Maybe one or two have dumped her. And now, in order to eat, she has to share a husband. She has to share a man because, she can't just go get a job. And in a lot of cultures, even today, right, you have this situation where you have to share a husband because after war there's a male shortage and you need to eat. And so if that's true, then Jesus isn't confronting her about her sin. Jesus is bringing up her greatest point of heartbreak.
Yeah.
And so we should probably picture an older woman maybe losing a tooth or two. And, you know, when she says to him, basically, when Messiah comes, he'll tell us all things. We've read that as her changing the subject to deflect instead of, this woman is longing for the Messiah. And Jesus, who in every other context is like, who do you say I am? What do you think? Isn't coming out with it to this woman. He just says point blank, I am. And he never does get a drink. You know, she drops what she's doing and runs to tell everybody she knows. And the ramifications of that for us sharing our faith are really important. Maybe we shouldn't start off with, what have you done wrong? That's part of the good news, is that Christ redeems the sin, but maybe it's that Christ cares about your pain. The Lord knows your pain. And if you're seeking him in your pain, you know, he wants to reveal himself to you.
It is a powerful lesson to be learned.
Mm.
Sandra, these are wonderful stories, and it's great to read them with fresh eyes, looking at the backgrounds of the story, looking at the cultural context, and realizing that so often we just make these characters one-dimensional or try to put them in a box and think of them as one particular way, when that's not fair, and it's not good hermeneutics either.
Yeah, it's not fair to the text. I want to add quickly that all the profits of this are going to International Justice Mission. Nobody here is making a profit off of this, except those that are on the front lines of working with the sexualized, vilified, marginalized.
And that is an extraordinary mission group, too. The work that they do in rescuing women and children from trafficking is legendary.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us again today. Wonderful book. Hope that you and your husband have a blessed Easter. And please let the folks know that wrote these wonderful essays in the book that people are really going to find their Bible study change dramatically when they read them.
Thank you for kind words. Jesus is alive. Happy Easter.
He is risen. He is risen indeed. And our thanks again to Sandra Glahn, the editor of Vindicating the Vixens, Revisiting Sexualized, Vilified, and Marginalized Women of the Bible from Craigle Academic, a division of Craigle Publications. Once again, all of the proceeds from the sale of the book will go to benefit the work of the International Justice Mission. Their job is to rescue women and children who are in sex trafficking around the world. They do remarkable stuff, and longtime listeners of this show will remember that we have talked to people from the IJM a couple of times before, and it might be about time to do that again. Thanks so much for joining us for Easter. We hope that yours is a blessed Easter and that you'll join us again next week right here on your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks so much for listening. God bless.